Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony's still recovering from an illness, so we've got Sean McNally helping me with the interviews. And today we have Digny Fingers.
All right. Good to be here.
Thank you, Digny. We will get this started now and get on with it, and we're going to talk about the channel. And your time at the channel from, well, I think it's the first date that Sean and I were talked about was April 2nd, 1983. And you were opening for The Make. Yeah, The Make. That was all in that time period, yeah. And just you and them. And do you remember anything to do with that, or do you remember anything about the channel in that time period?
Well, I do. I have some very nice memories of the channel back in the days. Don't remember that show in particular. I do remember a couple of incidents that stick in my mind. One, of course, you remember the dressing room and the stage. There was like a little runway that went between the dressing room and the stage, and there was a dance floor that was on the other side of that. Well, I remember one time I was out there just hanging out in that little area, and I was watching the dance floor and a couple dancing, and the guy was dancing with this woman, and she was smoking hot, man, just a real good looking woman.
Yeah.
And so I'm paying attention, and I'm thinking, boy, what, this guy's really lucky. And so I started to look a little closer, and I noticed that he's checking out all the other women in the club. So I'm thinking, oh, my God, this guy's a real dog.
I like that.
So anyway, and, you know, sometimes those kind of moments, they stick with you. And that one did. And I ended up writing a song called Another Girl about that, you know, little incident. And it was fun. I ended up on my Columbia record. And that was one that actually Vicky Sue Robinson sang the background vocals on. And Mark Rivera from Billy Joel's band. Mm-hmm. Little sax on. That was a real fun track that we put together, and all because of that little incident right there at the channel.
I like that one. Well, Sean has said that he's had a chance to chat with you. I haven't chatted with you since that time in the channel that we did.
We'll have to fix that then.
Yeah, we do. So I'm going to let Sean take it from here with his questions that I'm sure he's already got piled up in his mind right now about what he's been talking with. So are you there, Sean?
Yeah. I gave him some dirt to work with, so.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, thank you, guys. And you guys are going to get together in person one of these days. Dickie's in Plymouth and Digny down the Cape, right? You're not that far away from each other.
Yeah, I'm in Harwich, so not that far away.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I did go over a couple things online. I think, just kind of step back a sec. I know that my first interaction or knowledge of Digny Fingers was, of course, the video, The Girl with the Curious Hand, which was a radio staple, a video staple. Yeah. And that's really where you and the channel kind of connected at that point. But obviously, there's always a story before that. We'll definitely talk about the video and what's happened since then. But I do want to go back to like how you first got started in music, so to speak. I did know that, I read that your grandmother was a big influence. If you can kind of talk about your grandmother and how she kind of got you into the music and the bug and all that.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, my grandmother was, back in the day, she was an actress. And when she gave up her acting career, she married an Irishman, God bless her. And she moved back to Boston. And she ended up working at the Boston Symphony in the ticket office. Oh. And when I was, when I was a little kid, my parents lived with my grandmother and my grandfather, and she would take me, when I barely could walk, she would take me to Symphony Hall to, watch the orchestra.
Cool.
And I remember one time in particular, they used to make, back in the day, the orchestras had publicity books, and they would have all the pictures of, it would be like a bound book that you could buy, and it would have pictures of all the members of the orchestra and the conductor. And, of course, she had one, and they were all autographed because she knew everybody in the band. And in particular, one of the ones that was autographed was the bassoon player. And I remember she'd thumb through the book and point the members of the orchestra on it. She would always point that one out. She'd say, "And Bob, that's the lowest note that the orchestra plays," because he had put that note in as part of his autograph.
Wow.
And so
I like that. Yeah.
And so she drags me, I'm at the symphony one day, and what happens? She drags me backstage. Are you kidding me? What? I get to meet these guys that I've been thumbing through. And of course, who do I get to meet? The bassoon player. Oh my God, talk about starstruck. And, you know, I don't know if that was the moment when I decided I'd be a musician, but boy, I sure was impressed with that guy, I got to tell you. And then after that, you know, my mom's taught, we moved over to Lexington, and my mom taught Sunday school. And I didn't really like going to Sunday school, but I loved the choir. Yeah. And I sang in the choir from the time I was about probably 8 years old until the time I was maybe 12 or 13. I started out as a soprano.
Yeah, me too.
And then my voice changed. And it was really great because, you know, I was able to learn about melody.
Mm.
And then when my voice changed, I was able to learn about harmony and how harmony worked and how other voices were supposed to work with the melody. So yeah. It was a real education for me, although, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but it really set the stage for me being able to be a singer and be able to, you know, go in and work as a producer in the studio as well. So thank
you.
Great
Greg. Background. And I think at one point she even bought you your first instrument, maybe. Is that correct?
Yes. A clarinet. I should have probably at that point, I should have probably given up music. You know, when I went to school, I don't think it happens anymore, but there was, I think it was in first grade or maybe second grade, there was somebody that would come in to the classroom and they'd had all the instruments and they would demonstrate the instruments to the kids in the class. And then you'd get to pick an instrument to learn how to play. And what a great program.
Yeah.
And so I went home to my parents and I told my dad, I said, oh, I really want to play the flute. And my dad was like, what? What are you talking about, the flute? You need to play the clarinet. That's a man. Benny Goodman plays the clarinet. Come on. So I got stuck playing the clarinet. And boy, did I suck at playing the clarinet. I was really terrible. And clarinet is really, it's probably the most difficult woodwind to learn how to. Maybe the oboe is more difficult, but clarinet is very difficult to play because it's not linear. I don't know if you ever tried to play that type of an instrument, but it as you go up the scale, it's not linear. Your fingering changes, so it's very confusing, and it squeaks. If you do a clarinet, it squeaks. Oh, my God. I actually got so frustrated, I smashed it in half.
Oh, no.
I never found out about it because I was able to somehow fake it that I bumped into it and it broke by its own. So sorry, Mom. Sorry, Dad.
I think I also read when you did get to Lexington, that's where you know, kind of had your first good friend and he wanted to start a band. Maybe you can talk about that for a bit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My buddy, Leo. My dad had a couple of war buddies that he was really close to. They were my quote-unquote uncles. So my uncle Leo he had some kids, and they moved down the street from us in Lexington. And his son Leo was a couple of years older than me, and had been practicing on a drum pad. You know, a little drum pad that's only like 3x3 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so he'd been practicing on that for a couple of years. And he comes over to my house one day, and he's all excited. He's losing his mind. He's like, I got a drum set. And I'm going to start a band. And you're going to be the bass player. I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't have a bass. I don't, what? So, but anyways, my dad made a big mistake. he found one of his, my dad was a bus driver, and he found one of his friends that worked with the MTA had a son who had given up playing the bass. So I got an old Howard bass that the neck was like a parabola. You know, it was so warped. Yeah. And I got a 7-pound 610 amplifier for the bass, which was awesome. What a great setup. And then I started off in the band learning how to play bass. And it was pretty rough. We didn't even have a microphone when we started out. We had I don't know if you remember the old reel-to-reel tape recorders.
Yeah.
And they had a little round microphone that was really thin.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was as big as a Ritz cracker.
Yeah.
So we took that and we taped it on the end of a paper towel tube.
That's cool.
And that was our microphone.
That's funny.
That's great.
What age is that about, Digny?
What's that?
What age is that about? Were you kind of meshing out with the bass?
This is when I was still in high school. So, you know, probably 16, 17, something like that.
I guess from there, like, give us the transition into like the whole Boston music scene and becoming, you know, an actual artist, so to speak, and learning about what was out there. Like, how did you first get exposed to, you know, the quote unquote, the Boston music scene, for lack of a better term?
Yeah.
Well, you know, as in Lexington, I was in a number of bands, and I was in college up at Lowell University, and I had a couple of temporary bands up there, and we played in a couple of small places. So I was getting my feet wet. I listened to a lot of the early English Invasion stuff. That was really what our thing was, and then from that, I kind of got into the blues because I played harmonica too. And I started to listen to what the English guys were listening to because, you know, that was cool. And I really got into the blues and like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and those kind of guys. And then Billie Holiday too, as a singer, I just loved the way that she approached a song. So, I started to expand my musical education. And, then I was playing with this guy from when I came back after I finished school. I was in Boston and I played with this guy from Berkeley who was from Georgia. And then I started to get into kind of bluegrass and country music. And so that opened up a whole other. I always thought, you know, being a rock and roller, that was all trash and that those guys were a bunch of idiots and didn't know anything. But when I started to get into it, it was like, holy smokes, these guys actually know how to play.
Yep.
And the lyricists in the country music genre are they're just terrific. And people like Patsy Cline and some of those singers,
sure.
you can't top them. So, you know, Hank Williams and it's just like pure, it's almost like punk in a way, you know?
Yep.
So I was able to identify with that pretty easily. And that helped to round me out as far as my songwriting. So I think that was helpful in the long run.
Absolutely. And then, so you mentioned briefly, you before, you know, your name Digny Fingers became an act, so to speak, you did you were like a little punk band to get things started. What was that called and how'd that go?
The Spikes.
The Spikes, yeah.
A couple of songs that I think went on BCN. One was called Air Raid. That was fun. Yeah. Yeah. We played around, but like I said, we had this other band called Mono Vogue, which was basically a kind of artsy weirdo band. Yeah.
That's cool.
How long was that? How long that going for? Very short term or for a bit?
It went on for about a year or so. And then I started, you know, I was writing other songs and started to do different recordings and hook up with different musicians until finally I kind of, it solidified. When I met Danny McGrath, Danny was Danny from the Zoom TV show. I don't know. Okay. So anyways, I'm on the subway going to Kenmore Square. I'm on the subway from Cambridge heading into Kenmore. I got my guitar case and I noticed this guy sitting across from me. He's got a guitar case. So I'm like, hey, dude, what's up? And that was Danny. And so we got to talking and he was a bass player. That was a bass in his case, which is what I, because I was looking for a bass player. And so we ended up, working together. He's a great singer, and that was kind of the foundation of the original Dig Me Figness band, was me and Danny getting together, and then we added Paul Cantalori, who still plays with, I think, the Van Gogh Brothers. Paul's still an active guitar player. Yeah, he's continued his recording. And I think Danny, I'm not sure if Danny's still playing, but he's down in, last I heard, he was down in Connecticut living. So. Mm.
Yeah. And so that was essentially the base for the band. The band became Dig Me Figness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and Danny's has a cameo in The Girl with the Curious Hand as well.
Ah, no kidding. Okay. Mm. So how did you arrive? I'm just curious, like, because that video and that song was very different, it sounds like, than what you were dealing with before that. I know you got a pretty good rounded background, like you talk about the different, you know, from the blues and the legendary players, and then you were in the punk thing for a little bit, and, you know, you were exposed to a lot of different stuff. And it seemed like that time in Boston, this is like, you know, mid-80s, more like 82, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. There were so many bands, including you, but, you know, like New Miami, New Models, The Lines, New Man, Ball and Pivot, Men in Volts. I was looking at a few of these, you know, Rick Berlin, obviously, Rubber Rodeo. A lot of these bands are kind of hard to identify, or to say the genre, put them in a genre, so to speak. And yeah. I think you guys are kind of in that same boat. I'm just kind of curious how you end up in that sort of, I guess, mindset or that kind of musical direction.
Well, the good thing about the music or the Boston scene at that time is that it was anything goes, really. Kind of like, if you were a good rock and roll band, great, you know, come on down. If you could draw an audience, if you had something that was authentic, there was a place for you to play. And there were a lot of clubs that were open back then. And also, at the very beginning of the 80s, the drinking age was 18.
Yeah.
And so a lot more college kids that were on the scene and looking for original, quirky, kind of offbeat stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it was, there was a bigger demand for something different. And that's, that was great for the creativity of the time. There was a lot of different bands that were able to really push the envelope. So, and that's always good for the art.
100%.
Definitely.
Was that song, The Girl with the Curious Hand, like the first song, you know, quote unquote single that you guys put on tape, or how do you get to that point?
Well, I'd been recording, I'd recorded a number of songs prior to that one. That was, I'm trying to think when I actually wrote that song.
Yeah, I think it was 80s, right? So around that time frame?
Yeah, it was right, well, it was probably, I think we did the video in 83, so the song was probably around 81 and 82, something like that. Sure. But it was inspired by a tragic event. I was living on Green Street at the time in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And playing up at the Plow and Stars and doing all, you know, as a soloist, basically. Every once in a while, I'd go into Harvard Square. I was so broke, man. I was so broke. I'd go into Harvard Square. And there's a little kind of triangle in Harvard Square down by the past the Coop. And there was an outlet there that you could plug an amplifier into.
Wow.
So I'd go down there and I'd play for a little while until I'd get enough money for like a can of tuna fish. And that was good for the day.
Yeah, right.
That was so bad, man. Anyways, yeah. So, I can't believe I'm still alive.
That was before 83 or during 83. Is that what it was?
Yeah. But there was a woman that I knew down there. And, she had kind of a, she was kind of sketchy, and she ended up going down to New York. She moved down to New York City, and she ended up getting killed. Getting murdered. Somebody murdered her.
Jesus.
And, I'd known her and that she kind of was the girl with the curious hand, you know. She was like, uh-oh.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, the song really, sometimes you start to write something and, you know, it doesn't turn out the way that it started. And that's kind of, you know, I had that idea with the girl. She's like, you know, this is the girl with the curious hand. This is kind of got her killed, was her curiosity. And So, but the song didn't end up that way. It ended up kind of like as a, almost a sea shanty, which was kind of, it took a real right turn.
And that was filmed down in the Cape, yes?
Yeah. It was filmed in Truro and in Provincetown. Wow. And when I moved down to the Cape 12 years ago, I was going to this little theater group over in Orleans. And these things are really very casual. So you get, after the play, you get to go downstairs and hang out with the actors. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys who was the lead actor, he comes up to me and he's like pointing and, you know, tapping me on the chest. He says, "I know you." I'm like, "Really? Okay." He says, "Yeah, my uncle was the captain of the seaboat, of the tugboat that you filmed The Girl with the Curious Hand on." It's like, oh!
Yeah, wow, that's cool.
World.
I like that.
Talk about a small world, really.
So I'm curious, did the video come before? Did you release the song as a single first, or was it the video first and then the song started getting played because of the video?
I'm trying to remember what the sequence was. I think we recorded an EP, and had the EP ready to go. And then we released the video along with the EP on Starstruck Records. And we got some pretty good airplay on it. DCN, I think, added it as a, like a number one, blah, 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 for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then everything started to go crazy with when we won the MTV Basement Tapes.
Yeah, so it's important, like, as a time marker here, the MTV came about in literally in August of 81. So a year and a half, 2 years before your video. So MTV was, you know, so critical and helped really explode some bands because of their videos. And so you guys basically had submitted the video. They had a thing called Basement Tapes back in the day where unsigned bands could submit a video to MTV and they would play it and be like, you know, you vote for this one or the other one. They play both videos and you win that one, you go on to the next round, blah, 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 blah. So you guys submitted to MTV, and that was a very, very good move, obviously. So kind of tell us that lifeline. So you submit to MTV, become a Basement Tape winner, and that led to your record deal, essentially. So give us a little bit of background on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that we got a lot of exposure. We B66 picked us up. B66 was really happening back then. A lot of people didn't have MTV because it was cable, right? But everybody had V66 because it was a UHF station. And we were on pretty heavy rotation on V66. So I remember one day in particular walking through Harvard Square, and it was just like, it was like out of the Beatles. I had these little groupies that were like following me around and digging behind me and stuff. It was like, it was really kind of creeped me out. I got to tell you the truth. I wasn't really ready for that. But television is really where you get your exposure, and that was huge for us getting on V66 and then on MTV, because, you know, not only do you get the exposure on the television, but then the newspapers pick you up, the fanzines pick you up, so it's just like a big multiplier.
Right. And again, you mentioned it's kind of a funny in a way. You guys had to be, essentially were disqualified from winning. And why did that happen?
Because we got a record deal. The prize was a record deal with a shitty label. We got a record deal with Columbia. So, you know, we thought that was probably a good deal.
And trade off, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't like we had signed the deal yet. So I don't know. Probably should have held out, because then we could have had two record deals and that would have been even better, you know.
Then they talked about how dastardly the record industry is and was, and, you know, pretty bad stories, unfortunately, you know.
Well, you know, it's just what it is. A bunch of criminals basically trying to screw musicians out of money. There's a great book out there called Hitmen that really is kind of described what was going down in the 80s. And a number of the people that I was dealing with at Columbia are featured in that book and actually ended up in jail. So God bless him.
Yeah, happens. So going back to the channel on one thing, January 6th, 1984, the Ramones played and you opened for them and Mass opened for you. Now that's an intense lineup.
I remember opening for the Ramones at Framingham State. I do not remember opening for the Ramones at the Channel. It must have been
84 January 6th. You actually, after that, on February 17th, you opened for Robin Lane and the Chartbusters at the Channel.
Oh yeah, well I love Robin and Leroy, of course. Was the producer for a number of the tracks on the record.
That's cool. And then after that was December 31st. Remember, that's a big night. That was Face to Face was headlining, and you seemed to always be the middle act at one point. February 14th, 85, you do headline. That's when you first started that. But you're doing some great stuff. That middle ground actually is a better ground than opening or headlining sometimes, because people are more tentative, because by the time the headliner gets on them, it's pretty trashed.
Yeah. The shut down.
Yeah. But this, you had some really fun nights that you played here. I can really see the progression with the Channel, the Channel hierarchy. Well, he's done this amount of people, let's bring him up to the headliner now, this is 1985. And I'm sure talking about that, Sean, about the time when he first started doing the headlines.
Yeah, because and to Dinky's point, and just so you know, Dinky, there's an online database that Dinky built called BostonsBestLiveRock.com, which is one of the taglines for the Channel. And on there, it has every club date, every year, every date. It's an amazing database. So if you get a chance later on, that's where we find all your dates. It's BostonsBestLiveRock.com. It's pretty interesting and pretty cool.
I'm going to have to check that out, Dinky, because I'm doing a show now on WOMR down in Provincetown. It's all about the Boston rock scene. It's called La Vida Local. And so I'm going to use your website probably as a reference for some of these Boston bands that are coming in.
That's the podcast is on there too. The podcast is in six different media locations, from Apple to Amazon, that kind of stuff. Spotify, iHeartRadio. Yeah, yeah. But it's on there. There's 50 of them up there. There'll be 51 up there this week of podcasts on there. And there's videos from the Channel days. There's, we are going to put more up because we're finding them more on YouTube of people who posted the silly camera that we used to just mount in the top, and they took that $25 that they paid for to get a video and stuff, and they put it up there. And some of them are real good. There's a Rick Berlin thing that they put up the other day that's real good. So I'm sure that somewhere we may be able to find one of you and stuff on there, because
But boy, that would be great. I'd love to see that. That would be fun. Remember we had that big neon sign that we used to drag up behind us? Oh my God, the poor roadies. They cursed me every show, man.
I think back at that point, we're talking about when you first got to the Channel. This was like early 80s, 84. So your video had come out, obviously, when you're getting play. On the B66, on the radio stations, whatnot, you were getting a buzz. So I think Warren Scott was the booking agent, and he had a really good knack for putting bands on strong local bills to get the buzz, like kind of what Dinky was just saying, to get some exposure for the more people. Having the ability to open for the Stompers, Robin Lane, the Chartbusters, the Ramones, and that's a big show always. Then, Face to Face on New Year's Eve was one of the biggest nights of the year for the Channel. So to have... And you were like direct support to Face to Face at that point. So that was, you could really tell at that point, you guys were on your way to becoming a headliner. And essentially you did. After that show, you became a headliner from that point on for the next few years. You were headlining with Anthony Adventure Set. You did Rick Berlin. The movie had a couple. New Man. Some of the bands we talked about before. There were some great bands in that era. But that was kind of like that kind of launched you into the Boston scene and become an actual headliner there as well. And I assume you played around town and all over the Northeast at that point. Was there any touring going on with the Columbia? Do they have any kind of support for that, or how'd that all go together for you?
Yeah, that's...
Well, that, we didn't... See, what happened, unfortunately, is Noel Love was my manager at that point. And he is also the manager for the John Butcher Axes.
Yep.
And he had promised Columbia... This is what I found out later. He had promised Columbia that if they signed me, they could sign John Butcher Axis as well. And then, after they signed me, he went and signed John Butcher Axis to Capitol.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not
Columbia
good.
No like of that.
Mm.
So we got zero support from Columbia.
That's a shame. Yeah.
Well, that's... The record business, that's the Sharks, you know, so I was hooked up with the wrong manager. And
yeah, no, you weren't, unfortunately, you weren't unique to that person. I've heard the name, and, but, you know, that was a little bit before my time as far as work. I've been working with Axis for the last, you know, 10 years or so, and John for a while, and
yeah.
That was, you know, my time. I've heard that name over and over, and, you know, not exactly some of the most trustworthy people in the business sometimes, but, you know, the good thing is you're still doing it.
Yeah, at least I got signed to Columbia, so whatever. It's they can't take that away from me.
I was looking at there's a good it's hard to come. You came from an interesting background, you know, the post punk new wave thing, so to speak, is kind of where your video popped and became really really super successful and led to other things. And as you've gone along, you know, you get more into the blues, Americana, even country. And I just wanted, there was a great article or interview recently where they kind of summarized the beginning, and I'm just going to read it because to give them credit, it was Medium, or let me just see what the actual publication was. I think it was Medium or Authority Magazine. But anyway, I'm just going to repeat what they said to kind of better give you a better definition of what you've been doing. Digby Fignes is a genre-defying American singer-songwriter, band leader, and producer whose career has taken him from the underground punk clubs of Boston to the top of the national Americana charts. Without ever losing his signature mix of storytelling, wit, and musical invention. Whether fronting a high-octane band at a festival or captivating a house party crowd with just his guitar, Digby brings passion, humor, and seasoned craftsmanship to every stage he graces. That's a pretty great write-up.
Yeah, very nice. That's
a good way to see what you've been up to, right?
Yeah, well, life didn't stop in the 80s for me. I kept on recording, and I've had a number of CDs that have come out and received, critical acclaim as well as airplay all over the world. So I've been pretty happy about that. And, some of them have been picked up, and some of my songs have been picked up and used in movies and in commercials. And so I've been lucky as far as that kind of stuff goes. And my most recent CD I just put out this last summer, and that has a couple of videos off. One of the videos was done by the same guy that did The Girl with the Curious Hand, and that's received probably cumulatively almost 30,000-40,000 views so far. So, and
that's
it's also
great song.
That song "American Rose" is still on the Cashbox charts in top 100 on the Americana charts.
That's cool.
So, that's good stuff. So, yeah, if you want to check it out on YouTube, one of the Digby's newer songs, "American Rose," the video is beautiful. I mean, it's a beautifully shot video, and that's pretty cool that full circle, the guy who did "The Girl with the Curious Hand" did this one for you as well. That's pretty awesome. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah,
great song.
It was one of those things, you know, the song itself is very cinematic. And so with the release of the CD, I was getting pressure to, you know, do videos of, so I had a couple of videos out, one for the Emperor Wears No Clothes, which has also received a lot of views and it's still pretty appropriate these days. And another
100%.
One. Yeah. And so, but I was stuck. I didn't know how I was going to do this this one because, like I said, it's so cinematic. And so then I thought, well, maybe I can give Luis a call because he's one of my Facebook friends. And I'm saying, but I know he's going to, you know, he's been out on the West Coast doing movies and commercials. Like, you know, he's a real deal. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to afford him, but what the hell? I'll send him the song. I'll get rejected, and, you know, then I'll cry. So, but no, I sent him a song. He wrote me back in a couple of days. He was like, yeah, I love it. I've got an idea for it. Let's do it. And I was flabbergasted and just so happy because he's so creative. I mean, and he understands how to, I mean, he's went to the Fellini School of Filmmaking, so he knows what he's doing, and he's got a great track record, and it was wonderful to work with him again.
That's cool.
You described it perfectly. It's a really, really beautifully shot, beautiful. Everything you just mentioned is, it fits perfectly to that whole video. I think you did an awesome job with that one, for sure. Let me just go back a couple of different memories from the channel days. Like I said, you headlined probably a dozen times after your support for a bit. I just thought this one show really stuck out to me. August of 87, it was a great show, lineup wise, with Skin, Ball and Pivot, Diggy Figures, and Tribe were just coming up at that point. But that must have been a great show. It's full of some of the more popular bands at the time in that genre, so to speak. Any memories from either that show, any specific shows at the channel that you really have kind of stuck with you over the years?
Well, not necessarily as far as, you know, who was playing who, because, you know, when we go out, we're pretty focused on, you know, doing our thing. And so I don't really have the one memory I do have was when a kind of a riot almost broke out. And I don't know if we were headlining or if we were, I think we might have been headlining. And I don't know what the date was, but it was crazy. The place was full. And apparently there had been a busload of rowdies that had a keg of beer in their bus. And they, or maybe a couple of kegs of beer, and they were obliterated. And one thing led to another. All of a sudden, there's a crowd packed tight of a couple, 200, 300 people right out in front of the stage, like right in front of the stage. And right in the middle of that, this little fight breaks out. And it was just like a bomb. It started with just a couple of people, but then all of a sudden you could see it expand. And it was just like, somebody had spilt milk and it was expanding on the floor. And so I actually had to stop the band and called a 911 for all the bouncers. So everybody came in, they finally get these clowns out, but these guys are too stupid to stay out. and they figure a way, they come in the back, you know how the big double doors were back by the stage? Somehow they managed to jimmy those open and they reattacked. They came back in for like another surge. And all I can remember is that at one point there was like two or three bouncers that had one of these guys like feet and arms, and they were using him as a battering ram.
That's Sean you're talking to.
He's one of them guys.
Oh my God! Were you there that night? Oh my God!
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I did security for a long time there before I got into the booking and management side of things. And there were definitely a few nights like that. I'm looking back through the dates. I'm trying to figure out which show it might have been. There were a couple shows. I think maybe Contenders. Number one, you did have David Marsh's 30th birthday party.
That was show you did on the 14th. Yeah.
That was one of them. And then the other thing I'm thinking of, you did the Beat Magazine's first anniversary party, which was you guys, the Lines, Blackjacks, and the Drive. I can see some Blackjacks, I was a fan of doing that kind of stuff, maybe, but that's an interesting mix. Maybe it's one of those dates.
Wow, yeah, that was memorable. That one stuck in my mind.
Sure. Now, were you ever a fan, so to speak, digging and gone there to see some of your personal favorite bands, whether they be local or nationals? Any memories from those kind of attendance?
Yeah, coming in.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I love reggae music, so I remember going to see Yellow Man, and I love Yellow Man. I got to meet him in person at one point, but I love Yellow Man, and I remember I felt like a cube of sugar in a coal mine. You know, it was kind of cool. He'd rap, you know, and he'd rap in like this in the Jamaican patois, and I could barely understand it. But every once in a while, all the women in the place would go, ah!
That's cool.
Well, one thing that's cool about the channel, and this comes up a lot too, how diverse of a booking policy it had there, right? So. Oh, yeah. And really was the home, aside from the Western Front in Cambridge, which is a much, much smaller venue, of course, but the channel really became almost ground zero for all the reggae acts, you know, from the Wailers to Jimmy Cliff.
Oh, yeah.
Steel Pulse and Yellow Man and Third World. There were so many great bands that came through there.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You're lucky to have them, you know. Let me tell you another story I read about. The Boston Town song you put together. Let me give us a little bit of background on what that's all about.
Oh, that was one of those. I was, at that time, my paramour had a connection with The Who, and she had been, Roger Daltrey's, she'd been his, not maid, but
assistant?
Not his kid.
Personal roadie.
Yeah, personal roadie, exactly. Yeah, you know it. But anyway, so they were, The Who was coming to town, and so Charles had called Kim to talk to her about it, and then they knew that I was in the house, and so he said, "Hey, he was on a rant about Standell's song Dirty Water. He was sick of it, and he wanted to have a new Boston theme song. So he was trying to get people to submit songs to pick a new song. So he found out that I was in the house, so he gets me on the phone. He's like, "Hey, take me. Write a song for the." And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. Just leave me alone, will you, please? Sure, I'll write a song for you. And just to get him to shut up and leave me alone. But after I hung up, I actually came up with a song and that I thought was pretty good. So I recorded it in my, my little office on a cassette. And I sent the cassette into him, thinking nothing else of it, you know, whatever. This is some stupid contest. I'll never hear back. Great. But no, a couple weeks later, I get a call. Take me. Turn on the radio. They're playing your song. What are you talking about? Turn on the radio. There it is, my cassette. They're playing my cassette. I start to listen to it. All of a sudden, they turn it off, and everybody starts laughing. We're like,
it's not BCS.
Are you kidding me, man? This is what you send in. I got so pissed off. I called up a few of my buddies. I went into the studio, and I recorded the song with a band. And then I sent that back into them. And this time I was waiting for it. So I knew that when they were going to play it. And I'm tuned in. And this time they played the song all the way through. And I'm waiting for the jabs, the criticism. There's this big pregnant pause. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the studio starts applauding. So I was like, total vindication. I was so happy.
That's cool. That's cool.
Oh, yeah.
So we're in the finals. And where are the finals? They're in the Fenway at this club called the Wynwood at 6 o'clock in the morning. Are you kidding me?
So was this live during Charles's set? Were you guys like performing live at 6 a.m.?
I'm assuming, yeah, it was probably live. I'm guessing. I don't know. I was on stage watching these guys in the back bar drinking Boilermakers. I was in shock. You know, I couldn't believe my eyes. But I was there, and something was happening. And we ended up actually winning the contest, and part of the contest was recording time. So I ended up doing that first Boston Town EP, and that kind of got the whole Americana thing started for me. I mean, that was a weird little EP because I got a call like 3 months after I put it out, and it's the Country Music Association, the New England Country Music Association, and they're like, "Whitney, do you realize that you've been nominated for Country Song of the Year?"
Wow!
Like, what are you talking about?
I love it. That's awesome.
It's bad into good, that's for sure. Wow, after getting so disappointed the first time they played, and then you come back, it's like, "I'll show you," and here we go. It's the best song.
Big time.
It was another song that we recorded with the recording time from winning that particular thing. So, it's weird. Life is weird.
So you're, you could tell us what you're doing. I know you're still playing music. I know you got a very busy summer coming up. Like I said, you're on the Cape. I think there's about a dozen shows at least. Counting your calendar between Barnstable, West Dennis, Harrisport, Eastham, all over the Cape, essentially. So if people want to find out where you are playing, what's the best place they can go to find it out?
Well, they can check either Facebook or they can go to my website, dignyfignus.com, DignyFignus.com. And or just write me, bigfig@msn.com. I'll let you know. But if you're down on the Cape, just we're, like I said, we're playing all over the place. We have a regular show that we do at a place called O'Shea's in Dennis. We do a first Friday of every month there, and we play in Hyannis, a place called Finn's. And then we're playing up, we're playing at the Classic Car shows this summer, which is, that's always a great gig.
That's a good one. And, yeah,
that's a lot of fun. And you get to see some great rides, too. And then at the Harwich Port Stroll and a number of other, you know, the Windmill in East Ham. So a lot of different places. The summer is bumping down on the Cape. And all that, and then my radio show, which I've been doing like once every other week.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that. You did mention earlier the La Vida Local. So you've been basically, like you said, supporting other Boston acts on different episodes and whatnot. So it's been another common theme of these shows is how many people, you know, from that era, the 80s, are still doing music or still involved somehow. I'm going to plug your radio show a little bit. I know it's on WOMR or down the Cape. Yeah. So are there any, like, either upcoming shows or recent shows that people should tune in for?
If you go to the archive, you can they have the shows in the archive, but my next show is, when is it? It's coming up on April 7th, so it's next week, next Tuesday, Tuesday 9 to 11. And I've got, you know, I go back way back to the beginning of kind of the rock and roll scene with the Rock and Ramrod and Barry and the Remains and that kind of stuff. And then this week I'm featuring some of the blues artists like George Thorogood, who moved to Allston in the 70s, and of course Jay Giles and you know, Taj Mahal, some of those guys. And then get into some of the rockers from that are more familiar to my era, like the Stompers and Robin Lane and you know, the 2x4s. So, you know, some of the more obscure guys, Ball and Pivot. You know, got a lot of good stuff and. Try to keep it, try to mix it up as much as possible, you know, not feature the same songs all the time.
Sure. But, that's great. That's great. That's kind of what Dickie's been doing with this episode, with this podcast. Different genres, different people in the business, whether they're performers or booking agents or DJs or fans. There's so many different people that, you know, all are involved in that whole Boston music scene, as we know, right?
Yeah,
it's just kind of great to hear different perspectives and see who's out there still doing stuff and what they've been up to for the last 40 years, blah, 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 blah. Right?
Yeah.
Adventures in Dignyland. What's that all about?
What's that? Oh, Adventures in Dignyland. That's just me. I've been doing a lot of videography. And I was the Cape Cod Media Member of the Year. I've been starting to get into more putting videos together. So Adventures in Dignyland, that was just a kind of, you know, the crazy shit that I'm up to. Like, I've got a couple in the can where I climbed Mount, up in the mountains, the White Mountains. I've got a trail that's a nutty trail that I went up, and then, down in the grill, I've got a thing that I'm going to put together for that. And then also I've been working with an autistic kid called, John Oman, the autistic cowboy of Cape Cod. And I did videos. I've been giving him guitar lessons, and he's a really talented kid. And he, I've been encouraging him to write songs. And some of the songs that he's written have been very, actually really well done. And so I've recorded a few of them. And one of them we did a video for called Take the Old Horse for a Ride. And so, you know, that's really rewarding for me too, working with John and,
oh, that's cool.
And helping him. Yeah, helping him
Last question before we got to go here is over the time you've lived down here in on the Cape and whatever, have you ever had a chance to be able to run into Tony Raine when he was at the Melody Tent or when he was booking all those places you were talking about?
No, I haven't.
He lives down there in Chatham now he's recovering from an illness down there, so we haven't been able to get him on the phone or whatever. And I did work down with him and down in Dennis in the early time, but now I'm up here at the community in Plymouth doing this, and with Sean and we had Peter Limbo earlier on and what have you. But with Sean, he's got more because he's still at it. He's still doing the promotions. He's still booking. He's still doing what he was doing in the 80s and the end of the 80s.
I was going to say, one of your quotes I read, which I think is great before we end the call here, if you don't quit, you can't lose.
That is great. That's a good one. Dingley, I like that one. That's a good one.
Yeah. Words of wisdom from the truly departed, right? So, it's been a real pleasure talking to you guys. I got to say, it brings you back to the days. So, back when I was a blonde. Good Lord.
Yeah, but this is good. Okay, this is... just Dingley Fingness.
Do you ever get down to P-Town?
I'll be honest with you. I don't go out past 5 o'clock at night. I usually do sound checks in our local area. Unfortunately, I'm on dialysis.
Get your ass down there to do a show with me, be a guest DJ sometime. I want to see if I can get Johnny Barnes to come down and do one.
Yeah, he's living in Narragansett, I believe. It's not
Fairhaven, I think it's these days. But maybe he may have missed this the last time I talked to him. Deanie Lamont said he would come down and do a show with me as well.
Yeah, that's the fun stuff. But
I like to play the humans as much as possible. What a great band, and I love that song Jackie O.
Yeah,
I had a big place on Casey back in the day.
It's good stuff. All right.
Great band they were.
Well, here we go. We're just finishing up here. This is Two Pints in a Corner with Dingley Fingness and Sean McNally. And here, Dinky Dawson calling you and talking to you and saying, this is Two Pints in a Corner closing out.